Good morning. Welcome to our latest Employment Law 101 session. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We are based in the south of England, but we work with businesses that are all over the world, and they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. And that's where we help them. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning.
Morning on this lovely day.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're just talking about how nice and bright it is outside here in South Oxfordshire. Blue sky, sunshine. And
so let's all get off our screens and go outside.
Oh, no, let's finish our work and start the weekend early, I think. We are talking to you today about workplace discrimination in recruitment, specifically around disability discrimination. We're just going to be looking at a case or a situation, rather, that was reported in one of the papers last week, I think. Just a couple of housekeeping points. As always, these sessions are recorded, so if you want to watch them later or send them on to other people who are interested, you can do so. The video goes on our website, MPM Legal, audio on Spotify, and now Apple Podcasts as well. So we can be listened to on Spotify and on Apple. If you've got any questions, we absolutely love questions. We'll deal with them as we go, probably. Use the Q&A function down at the bottom. Obviously, you're joining us live, so you've got the opportunity to pick our brains a little bit, and we'll do our best to respond. So use the Q&A function down at the bottom. If you want to just chat with other participants today, you can use the chat function. I'm saying that. I don't know if I've enabled it for everybody, actually, but let me have a look at that in a moment. Okay, let's get into the topic today. So we are looking at a serial litigant and disability discrimination claims. Now, I'm not going to name the individual that's concerned because I'm recording this, and well, I don't think it'd be fair to, but there was a bit of an expose done in one of the national newspapers not so long ago about this person, because they have basically been applying for hundreds of jobs. So the individual has a disability, has applied for many, many jobs, and requested reasonable adjustments to the recruitment process, and in particular the application process. And the sorts of adjustments that have been sought are things like having the ability to apply by telephone, or at least talk through an application prior to submitting a paper application, and in some cases receiving interview questions in advance as well. Now, if the potential employers then refused or delayed making those adjustments, this individual would go online and fill out an ET1 claim form, press send, and start the litigation process against the company. And they would be arguing that there's been a failure to make accommodations for their disability, that that was unlawful, and that they had therefore been discriminated against. And this was an issue because in a lot of cases, it didn't really look like the individual had any hope of securing the job that they were applying for, which is obviously a little bit problematic. Now, over time, I mean, according to the newspaper report, this individual submitted thousands of job applications, and in terms of litigation, issued over 100 complaints of disability discrimination. Now, I've got a little bit of personal insight into this individual, because I have actually been on the other side of the litigation table. And I was curious after that case, because I was aware, when I litigated, I was aware of about 10 or 15 other claims, and it was quite sort of clear to me what was happening. So I kept an eye out. Of course, employment tribunal judgments are now searchable online, so you can put somebody's name in, and indeed you can put a business name in as well, and you can just see if there have been any judgments entered. So I mean, this is how sad my life is, I'm afraid, Adrienne. I would periodically
get out more.
I wonder if any more claims have been issued. Let's have a little look. And the number just kept creeping up. And I think it was at about 75 last time I looked, which is probably a couple of years ago now.
So that's just 75 claims that he's put on, that he's actually issued, let alone the number of applications and detailed dialogues he's had with employers that doesn't lead him to put in a claim. So
yeah, quite. I mean,
he's
well,
prolific, isn't
it's
he?
More. I mean, I think some judgments might sometimes fall between the gaps. And equally, if you bring a claim in the employment tribunal and then withdraw it, there's not automatically, I think some tribunals will not automatically issue a judgment to formally close off the case such that that judgment gets published online. So we've only got like a little snapshot. So you can see how feasibly you're into the hundreds in terms of claims that have been brought. Now, again, this is according to the newspaper report, which you might have to take with a little bit of a pinch of salt. But the newspaper reported only one case so far has been successful, but multiple employers have settled out of court. And that's obviously cost thousands, probably in legal fees and compensation, even if you're settling for, I don't know, 750 quid or £1,000 at a time. Now, some employers have tried to run the vexatious litigant matter. I think one of the senior legal officers has the power to be able to designate somebody, name somebody as a vexatious litigant, and effectively bar them from bringing proceedings. But I don't think that has happened to that particular individual. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because it actually, the tribunals don't just kick these cases out automatically, do they?
No, and I think discrimination is one of those cases as well where it would be very difficult for somebody to say they're a vexatious litigant if on the if on the face of it they're validly bringing an argument that there has been some discrimination. I mean, you could see the follow-up newspaper articles of that people would be up in arms about it. But yeah, I mean, I think the point being with discrimination cases, and it's something that frustrates an awful lot of my clients, is that there is a body of case law which says, in actual fact, unless it's blindingly obvious on the face of the papers, the tribunal does have to go to a full hearing in order to test and challenge all the evidence in a discrimination case before they can make a decision. So, I mean, I get employers coming to me going, this discrimination claim's an absolute try on. And I go, I feel your pain. I absolutely feel your pain. And, can we get it struck out? And the answer is invariably going to be no, because this is what the judges are required to do in terms of reaching a decision. So it's really irritating.
It's really irritating. And exactly that. I mean, the particular case that I dealt with, the individual submitted a claim for a job in a really, really specialized industry, very, very niche, very, very high tech technology that was involved. And it did look on the face of it like the individual didn't have the qualifications that were required for that role. But it wasn't absolutely, black and white. It
Left
wasn't as
field.
though the
Yeah.
application was, say to be a solicitor and there was no law degree or professional qualifications at all. It was a little bit closer than that. But there was clearly an issue. And this individual got in touch with our client and said, basically, you've seen my CV, you've rejected it, but you've not given me the opportunity to talk to you about it. And actually, I have a disability, and what you need to do is flex on your normal recruitment process at the SIFT stage and have a call with me. Now, to my client's eternal credit, they called me at that point. So rather than doing what we sometimes see, which is getting in touch after the event when it's way too late to be able to kind of reverse anything, that was the point they got in touch and sought advice and said, right, what do you think we should do here? And I said, well, if it's not too difficult, not too much hardship, why don't you have the phone call and say, okay, we'll have another look. And they did. They arranged a phone call with a, I think a senior, with a recruiting manager, with a senior person who was responsible for the role itself, and then walked the individual through the CV that they had submitted and talked about their experience. And then the individual was rejected because it was really obvious from both the paper submission and the discussion on the telephone that the skills and qualifications were lacking. Now, bear in mind that didn't stop the individual from pursuing a claim, and the claim went forward. I trotted off to the employment tribunal. I sat there next to this person in front of a judge and made some arguments about why the claim was doomed to fail. I'm not going to blow my own trumpet. I am going to blow my own trumpet and say the outcome for us was I persuaded the person to withdraw the claim. So it disappeared. It just floated off into the ether, and that was the end of it. But I did look on with sympathy when I was doing those searches for judgments to see that this person was still going with claims against other employers or potential employers. So it's a bit of
He's
a
made quite a
nightmare.
bit of money, hasn't he? I think the
Well,
newspaper reports say he
reportedly,
made a
but I
bit.
mean, it doesn't, it's not a stretch, is it? If you're getting 750 quid or £1,000 a time at a
As
commercial
a nuisance
settlement,
payment. Yeah.
then, you know, it'll soon rack up if you bring in like 1,000 claims. But
Yeah.
shall we just dig in a little
Yeah.
bit to kind of what the law is around
Yeah, that kind
discrimination
of
and treatment?
sets the background, doesn't it? I mean, look, I think it goes without saying, I think we all know discrimination in job hiring is obviously unlawful, which means, we can't treat job applicants unfairly on the protected characteristics, race, gender, age, etc. And to do so would be direct discrimination. And the only time you can justify it is if there is an occupational requirement for somebody to have a certain characteristic, right? So it's justified in that sense. And the law specifically says that employers can't discriminate on how they decide who gets a job, the terms and conditions of the job offer. So, for example, if you're recruiting for two positions and you recruit one man, one woman, you've got to be really careful to make sure the T's and C's are the same, and whether they offer the job at all. And here's an interesting bit that I just thought, how would this ever happen? Harassment, so unwanted behavior that creates an intimidating or offensive environment, is also prohibited during the hiring process. I mean, the fact that that needs to be written down in law is astonishing. But anyway, so I think what we've got to be really mindful of is it's very easy to say, I totally get that discrimination in the hiring process can't be on the grounds of the protected characteristic. So, I can't hire a man over a woman if the woman's more qualified, etc. But this is where, and we've talked about this before, this is where the discrimination goes wider than just the decision itself. And discrimination can kind of infiltrate into every nook and cranny of employment law. So that's where we all need to be a bit alive to ensuring fairness in all parts of the recruitment. So we're looking at how are your job descriptions drafted? Let's look at the requirements that are down in those job descriptions. As Peter's highlighted by talking about candidate X, the format of the application forms, particularly in light of the neurodiversity issues that we're all facing massively. What are your interview questions like, and what arrangements have you got for those interviews? So it's you can see how there is a real risk of discrimination just infiltrating every single part. So even if on the face of it your hiring policy looks fair, if it's applied in a way that disadvantages certain groups, it could still be considered discriminatory, and that's what then leads to the exposure of these types of claims. I mean, I've had a couple of recruitment discrimination claims, but that's normally you didn't hire me because of my age, or you didn't hire me because of my race. It's not really about the application of your process. So, most people nowadays, I think, are pretty geared up to defend those types of discrimination claims. Like, here's our notes. This is what we're looking for. This candidate had better qualifications, etc. So that's kind of more, I would say, mainstream. I don't really mean that, but you know what I mean. It's what we're used to defending in terms of potential claims. So, yeah, it's about the details of the actual process itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the related points there actually is about the record keeping part,
Yeah.
because
Notes, notes, notes.
notes, notes, notes. I mean, you and I were doing some line manager training off site on Monday, weren't we? And
Yeah.
it felt like I was becoming a bit of a stuck record by the end of that training, because really everyone who was there was probably dreaming about taking notes that night. Because I was just saying, make a note of it. If it's not a formal processes, make a note in your day book. When it comes to recruitment, I mean, the challenge that you've got is people can bring a claim up to 3 months after the act complained of. So if the complaint of discriminatory act, you're looking at a 3 month lead in, you've got to bear in mind ACAS early conciliation, which is going to stretch it out. I know some people are on the call today. We're on our round table session yesterday, where we're talking about the a group discussion on the Employment Rights Bill. And we know what's proposed in the Employment Rights Bill. One of the changes now is to double the limitation period for being able to bring claims from 3 to 6 months. And we talked through how feasibly it might be 8 or 9 months until you've got, an actual claim landing through the post box onto your doormat. And that's because, 6 month limitation period, individual goes to ACAS. Okay, if they're going to ACAS, it's a pretty good sign they are thinking about litigation. But still, you might be litigating on something and drafting your defence about 8 or 9 months later.
Well, it
What are
could be
you,
worse than that as well,
or
though,
worse?
can't it?
Oh, well, go
I
on
mean,
then.
it's we've had claims land where the tribunal hasn't got round to sending it out. So,
Yeah,
it is
true.
it's really tricky. You might have recruited somebody into the role. They've passed their probationary period. They could have even been promoted into the next level before a claim actually lands. And that is difficult in terms of producing the evidence to back up your decision at the time.
Yeah, so how sophisticated is your recruitment processes? I know we have like a range of organizations that we work with, and some are, I was looking at something a couple of weeks ago. Somebody was sort of screen sharing their hiring system, and it was super sophisticated. It was all anonymized information, it was moderated scoring. There were questions and then best practice answers with a scoring framework. It was great. It was ticking all of the boxes. But then other organizations just, for valid reasons, will not be able to have that level of sophistication. And it's done more, on the spectrum of things, you're more towards the back of a fag packet end than a super sophisticated bells and whistles HR recruiting system. It doesn't matter though. I mean, if you've got the records to show you're doing things in a fair way, you're going to have that information that you need in the future. So yeah, just talking more about the hiring process then. I always find absolutely golden information in the statutory code of practice, and it's something that's really easily overlooked. But the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which is the body responsible for enforcing the Equality Act obligations, preventing discrimination in society generally, but of course also within the workplace. And we talked quite a bit about their powers actually in the session before. It might have been the last session we did on McDonald's and harassment, wasn't it? And we talked about the enforcement powers that the Equality and Human Rights Commission have got. They have, I don't know, it's like 300, 400 pages of a code of practice. Now, it's not absolutely mandatory for employers to follow the code of practice, but obviously it's something that an employment tribunal is going to turn up straight away. And if you haven't followed it, you're going to be asked why. You've got to give a good explanation as to why you haven't followed the principles. And I think it's just worth picking out some of the examples that they've got. What I'll do is on LinkedIn after this, I'll put a link. So feel free to connect or just follow me on LinkedIn. I'll put a link up to the Statutory Code of Practice because it is a really good document to dig into to get those practical examples. But the sort of stuff that it talks about in terms of applications is things like a job description includes the task using magic report software to produce reports about customer complaints. This particular software is not accessible to some disabled people who use voice-activated software. Discrimination could be avoided by describing the task as producing reports about customer complaints.
Yeah, because you could see there how immediately, it's not that the employer wouldn't necessarily make an adjustment if it got a disabled employee, but the point being is by being that specific, the employer went, well, I can't use that system, doesn't work for me, and therefore wouldn't even apply. Sorry,
No,
interrupting.
exactly. And then the other classic is when I was prepping my notes for today, is it's the old we need somebody who's energetic,
Or dynamic.
Energetic or dynamic, and lo and behold, in the statutory code of practice, they call this out as an example. So the EHRC says, example, a requirement that the applicant must be active and energetic when the job is a sedentary one, is an irrelevant criterion. The requirement could be discriminatory against some disabled people who may be less mobile. So, if we were advertising for a job, I mean, you and I, it feels like we sit at our desks quite a bit as lawyers. Put an advert out saying, hey, we want somebody here who's active and energetic. There'll probably be some explaining to do as to why that's a requirement that's described in those terms. So in terms of job advertisements, then we know that they can be discriminatory themselves. So it means you've got to be really careful about how you're describing job adverts. And there is the really obvious stuff, which I know, I'd like to think all of you that are joining today are not going to be doing this sort of stuff. But adverts that exclude certain groups, so, men only or no over 50s, they're going to be unlawful. I mean, I have to say, I've been out to like pop out, get a sandwich at lunchtime, walking past some local shops. I've seen the classic A4 white bit of paper pinned up in the window. And you know, the amount of times I have read adverts and thought, no, you know, students only, or, you know, this job suits someone under the age of 25. And I thought, oh, that's a little bit, it's a little bit risky.
Yeah.
It's not great. But I know in your sorts of organisations, you're not going to be doing that. But bear in mind, even if someone doesn't apply for a job, they can still challenge a discriminatory advert. Okay. There was a law change in 2024. So a new rule, which is called Section 60A, or is found within the provisions of Section 60A of the Equality Act, came in. And that makes it unlawful for employers to make discriminatory public statements about hiring. Now, what that means is, even if there's no active hiring process, discriminatory comments about recruitment can still be challenged. And employers are responsible for statements made by managers or senior staff if the public believe they have a hiring influence, which I thought was, you know, it's very interesting, especially if you're like a senior business leader who, I don't know, does media rounds and might be quite well known and vocal in the business community. And the reason behind that, I mean, it's quite obvious really, but it's there to make sure companies are not discouraging certain groups from applying for jobs, even unintentionally. Now, the interesting thing about this provision, so it is in place, it is a law, but it is only enforceable by the EHRC. Okay, so the Equality and Human Rights Commission have the enforcement power. But I think they are becoming more activist on that. And, you know, we know from the session we did 2 weeks ago, we were talking about McDonald's and harassment. And particularly with regard to McDonald's, you know, they've had agreements with the EHRC about harassment in the workplace and how it's treating its workers. So I think the kind of the general progression and flow is to more of an interventionist approach by the Equalities and Human Rights Commission. What about getting these rules wrong, though? What are the consequences, Adrian?
Well, I think we all know that employees can sue for discrimination. That's how we started off this session, and many of you will be on the receiving end of that. In terms of compensation, I mean, it's like any other form of discrimination, even if the employee hasn't started, because they're looking at compensation for injury to feelings, and that's on a particular range. But there's also the compensation for the loss of opportunity to have the role if it can be demonstrated that they would have been given the job. So, you know, it's not a it's not a cheap claim to have to defend. That, you know, it carries the same risk as in employment discrimination. But on top of that, this is where the Equality and Human Rights Commission comes back in. As we've discussed before, they can come and investigate, as they did with the various other companies we talked about when we did our McDonald's session, and they can take action in terms of you know, suing separately under the section Peter's just talked about, but also then making sure that you then are looking at changing your hiring practices and improving, because ultimately that's what they want to do. They want to try and level the playing field for everybody. So yeah, so that's what happens if the rules are broken. But I mean, I just want to kind of move on a little bit to specifically look at disability discrimination, you know, and looking at this duty to make reasonable adjustments. We kind of know about these in employment, so flexible working arrangements to assist, such as working from home or adjusting hours. We've got the you know, the additional support, physical adjustments to the workplace, this type of stuff. But it's remembering that a lot of that can also be carried into the recruitment process itself. So, for example, you might be making sure that the interviews are at a specific time, which might work better to accommodate somebody. Remembering that reasonable adjustments are all about leveling the playing field, right? So if the employee is coming forward and, the candidate is coming forward and saying, I've got this particular condition, this is the impact that it has on me, and this is the adjustment that I would need to help me with that impact, that's what we're looking for. So, you know, take the physical adjustment. So, you know, at its most basic, you have an interview on the ground floor rather than make them walk up the stairs if mobility is an issue, for example. But certainly in things like, you know, in your recruitment process, you're looking at making sure the interview rooms are accessible. It may be that a remote interview is something that would work better. You might want to allow a support worker to attend the interview if that's what's required. offering communication support, and if specific technologies needed, assistive technology for remote interviews, just looking at all these types of things. It's about, I think it's about really having your eyes open to this stuff and being flexible to understand what conditions these candidates might have, and then looking at how what you can do. I mean, that simple thing that Peter talked about. This guy said, "I find the written process difficult. I'd like a telephone interview." That's a reasonable adjustment, right? It's cheap, it's easy. There's no sort of real reason to say no in that sense, because it's a reasonable adjustment, and there is that emphasis on that word reasonable. Okay, it doesn't mean you have to move heaven and earth. It just means that looking at the size and resources of your organization, is what the candidate asking for? Is it going to assist them in the process? And is it something that you can do? As I said, bearing in mind your size and resources. And
And
if so, then that's what you want to look at.
I think that's an important point, actually, because I mean, even amongst those of you that are joining us today, I know that there are massive variations in terms of organizational size. So some of you are working at businesses that have 2,000, 3,000 employees, and some of you are working at businesses that have maybe 40 or 50 employees, and the resources that you're going to have available are going to be different. And you're not under this uniform obligation to make identical adjustments across those two business types. And like you say, Adrian, that translates into both adjustments you're making to the recruitment process, but it does also feed through to general employment of disabled workers as well, doesn't it?
I mean, things that we're seeing more and more of, just to kind of give you an idea of it, is when we're looking at particular neurodiversity issues, a lot of people are saying, "I'd like the interview questions up front, because my neurodiversity, it means that actually I perform better when I have certainty, when I have the chance to prepare, all that kind of thing." Now, I know that kind of sometimes flies in the face of traditional interviewing, where you're trying to get the candidate to, well, see if they can think on their feet and give examples. But certainly in situations like that, that's where we would encourage you to take a, keep an open mind, particularly if you're looking at your job and thinking, well, the recruit for that job doesn't necessarily have to think on their feet. This is the job that they need to do. So actually testing their ability to answer quick fire in the moment is actually not related to the job. And therefore, yes, it would be fine for us to give an idea of interview questions up front, for example.
Because what's the justification? Because if you're challenged on it, you need to justify, well, we've taken this approach for these reasons. And I think that's a good example, actually. If you haven't got a job that requires thinking on your feet, and some jobs do, some jobs don't, why do you make that a requirement? Why is that baked into your hiring process?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and if you have got, if it is a job where you need people to think on their feet, then that's where you're going to be able to explain, well, this is why we do it. This is the nature of the role. Here's an example. This is specifically the skill set that we're looking for. So you're kind of tailoring it when you're looking at making adjustments in this way to make sure it's appropriate.
Yeah, we've had some interesting questions relating to this. So let's just take a moment to look at those, actually. So Karen says, can someone demand a reasonable adjustment, such as a call to apply for a job rather than filling in an application form, and refuse to confirm what their disability is? That's an interesting one, actually. I mean, I tend
Well,
to be quite pragmatic about this stuff and
yeah.
say, well, pick your battles. How inconvenient is it for you to not know what the disability is versus just saying,
Pick
okay,
up the phone.
yeah, we'll do this.
But I mean, from a legal perspective, obviously an employer, in order to discriminate against somebody, needs to know that they are disabled, or at least to have constructive knowledge of it. So, it's really tricky. If they just come back and go, "I've got a disability," you are into the technical argument of whether that's enough for you to have knowledge of the disability, or whether you needed specifically to have knowledge of the actual disability so that that would give rise to the duty to make reasonable adjustments. Now, all of that is a lovely long-winded way of saying we're going to make our lawyers lots of money, because those are the technical arguments that we're going to have to bring, versus the pragmatic, pick up the phone, tell us how we can help, tell us what your disability is, and let's have a chat about it, which is probably going to be an awful lot cheaper.
Oh, definitely. And then Terry, morning Terry, asks a good question. If you did, or poses a response actually, really. If you did allow a candidate to have questions in advance, could you give these to all candidates rather than just a candidate asking? Absolutely.
Great
I mean, you
question.
know, I've seen this in practice. So really, what you're getting into is restructuring your approach to the recruitment exercise for everybody. So the reason I like that as a solution is it levels the playing field, but you're not disadvantaging then people who don't have the disability either. You know, it levels it all out. So you're saying, okay, it's like an open book exam, isn't it? Or one of those maths papers where you can take your calculator in a way. Is that everybody get everybody you bring it to a level where everybody then has the same approach, but there's no what's the word?
There's no
Disadvantage, no
disadvantage,
substantial
but also,
disadvantage.
I mean, having that consistent approach is also great to tick off the potential risk of other discrimination. So, you might give the questions up front to that person who might be a male employee. You can just see it happening that a female candidate will go, well, they got the questions in advance because they're male. Now, we all know why they got questions in advance, but it comes back round to having to defend the claim. At least if you're having that consistent approach, it's a good thing to think about. And I think just like following on from your point about the maths exam, I always found open book questions were a bit of a red herring because you still needed to know your stuff, even though you could take the book in with you to answer the questions. So again, if you're looking at your recruitment processes, that's the kind of thought process you should perhaps be looking at. Do you want to just, we've got another question, which is also a really good one. Do you have a standard sentence to add to the interview invite saying something like, please contact us should you need reasonable adjustments to attend the interview? Yep, you can, I've seen that definitely in adverts, and that's demonstrating that you have got your open mind. And it may well be that you may not just want to restrict it to the interview as such, whereas please contact us should you need reasonable adjustments, full stop. And then it can be not just the interview, but applying for the job. But yeah, so that's the kind of starting point. Here's your open mind, but then also make sure that you actually back that up with action. But a good suggestion.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's loads of other practical stuff you can do in terms of the accessibility of online application platforms and the like. There's a whole other interesting thread to go down, which we're not going to get into today in the interest of time, but the intersection of artificial intelligence and how AI tools are used in the recruitment process as well. And then there's a whole series of discussions to be had and concerns at the moment. I mean, spoke at an event last year about this in terms of especially with large language model AI tools and how they learn. And if you get discriminatory information going into the system that they're learning from, so stuff that's biased, then they're going to be, you know, learning in a discriminatory way and you're going to risk getting discriminatory outcomes. And I know some organizations are using types of AI to certainly filter out job applicants. So there is a risk. There is a risk there.
I'm just going to jump in at the end there and throw in another completely nerdy risk when you're looking at using AI to filter in your process. Go back and visit your privacy policies that you're sending out to your candidates, because under GDPR, you need to be super clear with candidates that you're using automated decision-making processes. So just wanted to chuck that out there just to really make your day on this fine sunny morning, as if you didn't all have enough to think about.
No, absolutely. Did we speak about adjustments to the recruitment process in terms of asking around health information?
No, we didn't. Do you want to just, yeah.
Yeah, no, happy to. So, you know, the general position is that there are only very limited situations that you can ask about health in terms of the recruitment phase or ask questions about disability. But like Adrienne said in response to the question that we had, it is sensible to ask or consider whether adjustments are needed at any stage of the recruitment process to accommodate a disability. But that's a different, there's a distinction between asking about adjustments in the
For the job, yeah, but
in terms of the practical arrangements you're putting in place for the recruitment exercise. So do we need to hold the meeting at a certain time, certain location? Do you need any physical aids, that sort of thing, versus the actual core requirements for the job? And if you're asking for those purposes, which generally isn't permitted. And then a lot of it is just common sense in terms of practical arrangements, isn't it? Have you got accessible interview rooms? If you're doing an online meeting like this, are you doing it in an accessible way that somebody can join? Do you need to adapt those tests or your selection exercises? Do you need time tests? Do you need to allow for extra time? Is there other communication support that needs to be needed? But I think overall, your starting point is what's the role you're recruiting for? And then you're building your recruitment process out from that, because that then puts you in a position where you can justify why you are taking a certain approach. I'm mindful of time. We've gone over a little bit, so apologies for that. Anything else you wanted to chip in with, Adrian, before I close out?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just being aware that, you know, we're in very much a very fast changing world when it comes to this type of thing. And it's just trying to keep that open mind and remember all this stuff when you're hiring for somebody. It's not that easy.
No, it is developing. And I think it's definitely neurodiversity related issues, which are the hot topic in terms of discrimination in recruitment. So as always, as we come across these interesting cases or situations, we'll keep you up to date. In terms of key takeaways, then, just consider the job adverts that are going out. They have the scope to be discriminatory. You know, there can be legal liability for those. So you want to make sure that they're inclusive. Make sure your interviews and application processes are fair and accessible. Avoid public statements from your organization or anybody that is senior or influential within your organization that could be seen as discouraging certain groups from applying for roles with you, because the Equalities and Human Rights Commission do have enforcement powers, which we'll then use. And then a really important one, I think, train your managers or train your recruiters to understand exactly what the legal framework is and how to follow the rules. You know, what we don't want to see, I think some of those employers, dare I say, that have come and stuck with this serial litigant have maybe taken a bit too much of a inflexible mindset towards what they do on recruitment. And it might be, look, we believe we have a fair process, so we're not going to flex for you, Mr. Serial Litigant. We're just going to do it the way that we've always done it. And obviously that's led to certain consequences for them as well. So I think a big part of this is training people within your organization just to understand what the rules of the game are and what leeway you've got and why it all matters as well, because we're all about minimizing that legal risk. That's it for today. We kind of bombarded you a little bit with that, but I hope you found that useful. As I said at the outset, all of our recordings are on the NPM Legal website. We're on Amazon Music. We're on Spotify as well. We're on Apple Podcasts. So do have a listen back. I think this is our fifth session of this year now, so we've got some good sessions to go back and look for. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I can't tell you yet what we're going to be talking about, right? We're going to come up with a fun case, aren't we, Adrian?
I hope so. Yeah,
something.
I hope so.
So we'll be back.
Be surprised, all of us.
We'll surprise you. So please look out for the invites, and we look forward to welcoming you in a couple of weeks' time. But for now, enjoy the blue sky and the sunshine, and have a good rest of the week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.